I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello. This episode is brought to you as part of Wanted Design Manhattan Online, a conversation series presented with Design Milk and Clever. Each day, from May 11th to the 22nd, 2020, we'll feature design dialogues, including new episodes of Clever and engaging live conversations with very special guests. To view the schedule and register for events, head to wanteddesignnyc.com/online. That's wanteddesignnyc.com/online.
Having those businesses without even really thinking about it a great deal, just doing it with your friends and doing it part for fun, part for profit, really gave me the confidence to get on and use my creativity to forge my own path.
Hi, everyone. I'm Amy Devers, and this is Clever. Today, I'm talking to famed British industrial designer Tom Dixon. Tom Dixon grew up in England after spending his first 4 years in North Africa. He discovered guitar and ceramics in adolescence, and later, after dropping out of art school, he taught himself to weld and made a line of salvaged metal furniture that got him noticed. He worked with Capellini in the late 1980s to create his now iconic S chair. And since 2002, he's been operating his eponymous design brand, designing furniture, lighting, accessories, and interiors. His work has been acquired by museums. Her Majesty the Queen has appointed him an Order of the British Empire. And even though he's firmly established on the international design scene, don't call him establishment. He gets testy about that. Here's Tom.
My name is Tom Dixon, and I'm from London, England, and I'm a designer and an entrepreneur. I create things for a living, which is a great way to spend your life.
Yes, it is. And speaking of your life, let's talk about how it got started. I understand you were born in Tunisia and then grew up in England. So what can you tell me about your formative years? And, you know, what kind of kid was young Tom? What kind of things captured your imagination?
Well, I spent 4 years in North Africa, in Tunisia, in Egypt, and in Morocco. Arrived in the north of England when I was four, which was a bit of a culture shock. I guess I was used to running around naked in the hot sun, and then to come to damp and green England was really quite different. My mother is half French and half Latvian. My father's English. So I have a series of different cultures. But because we traveled so much when I was tiny, I guess it probably did have quite a lot of influence, certainly on things like food culture, sense of humor, cultural references. And I guess a lot of creatives have traveled a lot in their infancy. But I came to London when I was five, and it's been my hometown ever since.
And why for the transition from North Africa to England?
My parents were just looking for work, you know.
When you think about what kind of culture shock that was, how do you think that, you know, manifested in terms of your worldview?
I don't know. It's easy to post-rationalize. But I guess, you know, the Mediterranean, I guess Arabic culture, the desert, you know, I remember many animals, you know, locusts, storms, camels, flying fish, you know, and very little, very little else. The Suez Canal, But, you know, I think the light and the difference in light struck me even at that age. We came to the UK in a very, very cold winter with snowdrifts maybe 5 or 6 feet high. And that was a real contrast in terms of climate.
And how did your creativity start manifesting? What kinds of things were you interested in, and how are you acting that out?
I don't know. I was a very timid boy, and I spent a lot of time in books until I was about 11 or 12. I went to a really very poor school academically, which I found actually relatively easy because I'd done so much reading. But what struck me there was the art department. It was a big school, a state school, and it had an amazing art department with life drawing, with metalwork, technical drawing, woodwork, and ceramics. I think it was the ceramics department which really kind of taught me the transformational power of design on materials. You know, so clay is the archetypical ugly departure point, sort of very muddy and greasy material with no shape, and then just finding shape in that and transforming it from a soft and wet material to a hard functional material, I guess, stayed with me.
Did you have siblings, or were you kind of left to your own devices? And what kind of teenage years did you have? Were they rebellious or chaotic?
I have a sister. She's an osteopath in New Zealand, so the other side of the world. Mm. And was I rebellious? Eventually, yeah. It took a little while to come out, but I was always contrary. Didn't really want to do what other people were doing. I think I discovered guitars at about 16. And then, you know, typically like most British kids of the time, probably American kids too, you were in a band. It was kind of what you did. So it was really through that I found a way of monetizing creativity, I guess, and also found a way of communicating. And, you know, I've often observed that bands are really also entrepreneurial outfits. You know, you have to drive your own van, you have to make your own posters, you have to create your own tunes, you have to learn your own instrument. And if you're any good, then you can start making money out.
You know, bands are also really a hardcore collaboration on every aspect of the business and the creativity. But not only that, you're in vans traveling around, frequently sleeping in the same hotel rooms or on people's couches.
Have you been in a band? Sounds like you've been in a band.
No, I've been close to band members, though.
Right.
So I've witnessed it. It made a giant impression on me what level of collaboration you have to be involved in order to be in a band, in order to make it work. And I'm wondering how that influenced, how that stuck with you.
Well, it definitely made me want to do something on my own.
there's a little too close.
There's nothing worse than being really stuck for that amount of time with people that are that hormonal at that age and that smelly. I ended up doing all the driving.
Yes.
Really wasn't fair. But, you know, I think that, you know, there's always multiple egos. And after a while, that I sort of hungered for solitude and doing something on my own. But you're right. Design is also collaborative. You know, particularly when you're getting things made and selling them. There's also a big collaborative element now. So I've grown to love it again, but more at a distance, less in the transit van.
Yeah, it's a little bit more procedural, so you can collaborate in stages. The band, it's sort of all in. But there was a chapter of your life that included becoming kind of a successful London-based band and touring and opening up for some major acts and a brief chapter of art school before dropping out. Can you tell me about this stage of your life? Because it sounds kind of turbulent, pivotal, and ultimately very expansive.
Yeah, it probably was turbulent. But I immediately after high school, I went and tried art college, which really didn't agree with me. And that was mainly because, I guess, the earlier experience when I was younger was all that I needed to try and dabble a variety of different disciplines, you know. And
oh, yeah. So you already had that experience. Art college probably wasn't that novel.
So it was disappointing, really. I'd imagined that I'd find lots and lots of people like me, and I didn't really. So, you know, so that lasted maybe 6 months. I drove into a car on a motorcycle and broke my leg, and I never went back. So I spent 3 months unable really to move. And after that, I just went and got a variety of jobs. I was a printer, and I was a colorist or colored in cartoons when they were still colored by hand. And it was that time that we took off as a band, and yeah, we signed a record deal. We were a hot thing in London for about 6 months before we got signed up, and that was the fun time. Had our own destiny and played to our own crowd, and it was as soon as we signed to a big megalithic corporation that we ended up as support bands for. Yeah, so we came to America. First time, my first encounter was America, was with Clash on Broadway. And the Clash had been extremely generous in bringing over a different act every night to support them from London. But that was an unpleasant experience because we were slightly disco and they were very punk, and the crowd was expecting punk music, so they didn't like that. So there's a variety of, of all the bands were jazz or reggae or disco, and then the Clash supporters really, really didn't warm to any of the support acts. So it was a disaster, but it took us really to record at Electric Ladyland, which is Jimi Hendrix's studio, record a first single, and then get back. But, you know, so I did that for a couple of years, but then I had another motorcycle accident and broke my arm. That was the end of my bass playing career.
At that point, were you sort of planning to be a musician for your career?
No, I'm always in awe of people that have got a plan. And there's many people that have planned their careers and their lives and have studied to be what they are. But I had no plan, and I just went whichever way the wind blew. And I knew I wanted to work. And so we'd picked up a bit of the club culture that was going on in New York at the time. We brought it back to London and set up a couple of nightclubs, which were sometimes legal, sometimes illegal, and brought back this idea of entertaining people in the clubs. And the clubs had stages, and I really taught myself to weld really as a kind of way of making stage sets and performance in these clubs. And the club world is a very good way of getting to know a lot of people superficially. A lot of those people end up being hairdressers, fashion designers, photographers, people that need stuff. You know, so when they knew I made stuff, I became the metal worker.
It's a very scrappy, creative, resourceful, DIY in the punk sense kind of tribe. The club scene, the band scene. And it's very entrepreneurial in that people are sort of not following any sort of prescription, and they're just taking the resources they have at hand and making it into something. And it sounds like that suited you quite well.
Well, it still does, really. I mean, I'd rather make up my own rules, and really having those businesses without even really thinking about it a great deal, just doing it with your friends and doing it part for fun, part for profit, really gave me the confidence to just get on and use my creativity to forge my own path. So that is really what I continued doing for quite a while.
You're teaching yourself to weld as a way to build stage sets and entertain. At what point did it sort of morph into welding a collection of furniture that got you some attention and put you on the map as a designer?
Well, so welding is an amazing technique because it allows you to build things really quickly and with no fear. I think, you know, if you're a woodworker, you tend to have to be more measured, more precise. You have to wait for things to happen, like gluing. You have to cut joints. You know, welding allows you to just put things together. And those things can be very strong and dynamic. And if it doesn't work, you can cut it apart and start again. You know, as well, the streets of London were a place where you could find a lot of metal, actually. There was a lot of houses being converted at the time and, you know, metalwork being chucked out. It was free. And so I think the only thing that I had wasn't really skill. You know, I can't call myself a craftsman. It was much more just persistence and practice. You know, I think all too often people don't get enough practice at making things. You know, and that was the beauty of the metal. It's like if it didn't work, you could reuse it. but I was very productive and I made a lot of things and I made them for fun. And then people started buying them. And I just thought, well, this is extraordinary. This is like being a baker or something. You can make something and sell it the same day. And there was a freedom to that existence and an autonomy.
How would you describe the transition? I don't even know if it's a transition. It's an evolution into a full-blown designer working with Capellini. How did that come about, and how were you feeling as you were growing into an established international designer?
Well, I still don't feel like an established international designer.
Well, that's refreshing. I mean, I don't even know what that feels like, but I assume after this long of a career, you might have accepted it about yourself.
Yeah, don't call me establishment. That's an insult. So London was recognized as a place that people came to see creativity. There's a strong tribal scene of goths and still remnants of punks and skinheads, new romantics, and the music scene was still really strong, and the club scene was strong, and people came for alternative culture. And at the time, you know, I really wasn't selling a great deal to English people or British people. I was selling more to people that were based in London, people that were, you know, Italians in finance or Japanese people coming over for the week, or Germans that were coming to show something new in their art galleries. There was no real domestic market. You know, London and the UK was still in pretty steep recession at the time. So I had an international audience, and the Italians came knocking at the studio door. Capellini was one of the first to break with the tradition of mainly using Italian studios to do the creative direction of their brands. And he'd been looking for new ideas. And, you know, London was known, you know, for alternative culture, mainly in fashion, I think, rather than furnishings. He came to my studio, but I think probably I met him in Milan before that. I'd been asked to do an exhibition with Mark Newson and what became Corso Como 10. I don't know if you know that shot.
That's making sense, how all the dots connected.
And he selected that chair, which I'd probably tried half a dozen ways of making as something that could sit in his collection. So I licensed it to him. That gave me a kind of access to the Milan Furniture Fair, gave me access to an international reputation, I guess. And it was a very innovative company at the time, which people were very interested in. So that's still in production with Capellini now, all of those years later.
Well, I just spoke to Giulio Capellini, and he related his talent for spotting long sellers, not best sellers. I think it speaks volumes that that chair is still in production. Is that the first piece that you achieved a certain scale with, from hand welding salvage furniture to going into production with the S chair? Were there a lot of pieces in between?
Yeah, I mean, we're talking probably 7 or 8 years in. I mean, I had gone from making things myself, sometimes, you know, on stage on my own, but to having a metal workshop with 10 or 15 people making things, you know, in batches, working to commission or doing exhibitions. And so it wasn't a one-man show. And I probably produced 100 of those chairs in a very different form, covered with rush basket work, sometimes inner tubes of tires before Capellini saw it and made it in the way it's made now.
You're now, let's say, 30 plus years into being a designer of furniture, interiors, objects, accessories. How would you characterize your overall evolution, both creatively and musically? I mean, all of it. Like, how would you describe?
You know, I had a lot of other stages as well, which included also spending 10 years as creative director for a company called Habitat, which never really existed in the US, apart from one store. But it was owned by IKEA at the time. So I'd jumped from being a self-making designer to working for one of the biggest in fact, the biggest furniture company in the world. And so I spent 10 years there before I started my own label again. So what's atypical about me is that I had a broader series of experiences from, you know, self-making to working in corporations to doing my own label to working with the Italians. So there's just a broader sweep of experiences there, which are also very different market levels as well. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in all of them still. I'm interested in making things cheap and making things expensive. I'm interested in industry and I'm interested in craft and that. And then I'm also interested in things which aren't design. I'm still interested in music, but I'm particularly interested in food right now with, you know, a couple of restaurants that we have. And that strikes me also as, you know, something which has a degree of similarity to some of the entrepreneurial things that we were doing before. So, you know, restaurant also has this thing of making something, you know, like producing something, which I really like. Mm-hmm. It's also got the kind of creativity that you get in the music businesses. You know, I'm hoping that I'll have more and more unexpected adventures in not just design, but also, you know, other fields as well, where I bring the experience of design into that next field as well.
What I'm hearing from you are a couple of things. Between music, welding, and food, there's an immediacy to the creation that sounds like it appeals to you. There's also, you've set up your brand so that you can also still experiment. That's sometimes economically hard to do, but you're making it work. It sounds like it's probably a crucial part of keeping the joy alive is your ability to experiment and follow your curiosity.
Yeah, I mean, that's half the point of doing it, is to be able to surprise yourself again. I mean, I can't imagine what it must be like to go into the same job doing the same thing every day. So I've purposefully set up my infrastructure to allow me to have a series of different and.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Support for Clever comes from Wix Studio. Instead of reading you another, let's be honest, boring ad script, Wix Studio just sent me this wild-looking Alice in Wonderland-themed website to scroll through and tell you about. So, whoa. This is not the web I'm used to. There's something called mouse parallax, which makes it feel like you can go deeper into the screen. And as I scroll down, it's like I'm falling down the rabbit hole. And things are moving in depth and perspective. Even my cursor has morphed into a glowing little orb. There are all these no-code animations that make this place feel organic and alive. And Alice is wearing some pretty cool shoes, by the way. Okay, I know I'm mixing up my narratives now, but we are definitely not in Kansas anymore. Your turn to go down the rabbit hole. Build your next web project on Wix Studio, the platform for agencies and enterprises.
Sometimes conflicting events going on. I mean, often I'm working much less as a designer and either more as a, you know, marketeer or a product developer or an engineer, and all of the things that surround design as well. And sometimes I even think that design is a bit of an odd word because, you know, it's a relatively recent invention, you know, where it was called before, I don't know, decorative arts or something. You know, it wasn't seen as the thing that it is now, and it's also become such a baggy word which encompasses so many different types of activity, which could range from styling to software design. So I find it very imprecise as a word to describe, you know, the multitude of different things you have to do to not only think up new ideas, and but also put them into production and then find a way of communicating them and wow. making people interested in enough for them to part with their hard-earned cash. You know, so we do that and lots of things around it and try and keep the whole thing alive at a time when it's increasingly difficult to be a smaller brand, and it's even more difficult to be in, you know, certainly in retail, and some of those ways that you used to get things to market before have become harder and harder to do.
You talked about food, which I think is really exciting, and I want to get more into that. But before we talk about food and some of your experiments that are ongoing, you said that you like to surprise yourself. And I think one of the common pitfalls, or certainly some of the things I've heard from other people, is that there's a point at which, when you're scaling your business, at which you can kind of fall into a trap where you become more of a manager than a designer. So the fact that you've set yourself up, your business up, so that you can still surprise yourself and experiment is maybe not as obvious as you might think for some other people. So is there anything you can share about some of the challenges in terms of creating that space for yourself?
Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, I think you're probably better off, you know, from a consistency and a financial perspective, not challenging yourself constantly. I think people appreciate almost too much consistency. But, you know, for creativity alone, you have to constantly put yourself into, I'd say, uncomfortable situations and try and push yourself to try things that you're not familiar with. And I think it's good to be expert when people come to you for your expertise. But at the same time, you have to find a way of injecting freshness into your core capabilities. Otherwise, it will go stale very quickly. Having said that, you know, the modern world demands you to be fresh and new almost every day now. And so that's also something which actually suits me quite well, because I prefer doing new ideas and finishing off old ones, you know. But what we've managed to do is to have, you know, a few successful globally products that allow us to experiment around the edges, and then also try and rethink always what, you know, what a designer can be if they want to self-produce, and try and think of an original way of getting things to market.
Is there a piece or a project that really stretched you in terms of your personal growth, or really surprised you? You surprised yourself with?
I try and push slightly the limits of what we do. So, I mean, the one that interests me at the moment is the one we were talking about just a second ago, which is kind of the restaurant. Mm-hmm. So really it's partly actually because I took a studio which had a commercial kitchen inside it, and it seemed a shame to pull it out and throw it away. But it was also partly because I thought once that opportunity was presented to me, that it would be a much more clever and interesting way to have a furniture showroom than having a furniture showroom, because, you know, furniture showrooms are in essence relatively static,
and
you know, in the way that people buy furniture, which is particularly large pieces, once every 20 years or maybe even once a lifetime, it's really not a particularly attractive retail proposition, particularly in a world which demands and requires, you know, freshness and newness all the time. So, you know, the way you have a furniture or justify a furniture showroom in a city centre might be having a restaurant. So it's a complicated business. I can't really recommend it for anybody else, but a series of circumstances put me in a position where I could do that. And rather than saying, well, no, that's not my core business, or restaurants are the riskiest proposition of any business you could get involved with, it just seemed to fit because we had the furniture, we had the kitchen, and we needed to bring in more people, and I wanted to give life to a space. And so food does that, and it does that and recreates itself every day, or twice or three times a day if you do breakfast as well, you know, and it gets a lot of people through the door if you can have a successful restaurant. But of course, we do the base of a restaurant, which is what it looks like and what it, you know, the comfort that you sit in and the table that you sit at and, you know, the glasses that you drink from and the light that illuminates the place are all the things that we do. And it's worked really well in terms of trying to demonstrate not just a design style, but how you live with the stuff.
Well, that's what I was going to say, is a furniture showroom is really just hypothetical. Like, here's the piece, and you can try and imagine what it would be like to live with this. But it's sort of unapproachable in that you're not supposed to enjoy it. But in a restaurant setting, you really can. Like, not only is the piece something that you're trying out interactively, but you're actually making memories and breaking bread and bonding and forming a relationship with the pieces, even if it's short term. But I think that right there is essentially what a long-term commitment with a piece of furniture is about. So there's a distinct materiality to your work that I presume comes from an intimacy with materials. And I wonder if that's changed for you over the years. I mean, I don't know if you're still welding as much as you used to.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, like I've said earlier, I get bored very easily, but you know, I also get obsessed with a specific material or often a manufacturing or craft technique, and I tend to explore it as deep as I can possibly go for a reasonable amount of time and then move on and then toy with it again later on. So, you know, the steel was definitely the thing that made me into designer, although ceramic, you know, mud, clay was the thing that pointed me in that direction. You know, at the moment it's glass. I've got a lot of ideas for specifically pressed glass, which is often used industrially, which I'm trying to do in different ways. But I've had experiments with soft materials more recently with a lot of textiles, which allowed me to get a lot more comfort and a lot more color into what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my metallic tastes have evolved from steel to copper to brass and now really quite a lot of aluminium and stainless steel. There's definitely a thread running through there, which is the materials are always the departure point. And again, you know, I quite like making the analogy with food, which is that, you know, the chefs that I like are getting very good raw ingredients and they're respecting them. They're trying not to mess with them too much. They're trying to get the best out of their materials. And that's kind of what we do in the studio. And of course, we're more intimately connected to materials because we also have to, unlike a lot of designers who haven't set up to do their own production or their own stock holding or their own retail, is that we're very close to the people that make the stuff. So we know all of the manufacturers and, you know, they're all over the world, but we've been to all of the factories and we know the people that make our stuff.
Well, that's a nice connection. Are you cooking? Are you exploring food in that way?
Probably a bit more in the last restaurant than this one, which is actually really busy. So you have to make a proper heavyweight commitment to starting your shift at 3 in the afternoon and then going all the way through to midnight. I've become slightly lazy in professional cooking. I used to do a shift a week at the other restaurant, which is a bit lazier and more relaxed. But this one is in a more higher volume restaurant. Of course, it's closed at the moment, but we're hoping to reopen.
Is this a time of experimentation for you? Or, I mean, in the kitchen or otherwise? I know that, you know, we're in a space and time that will forever be marked by COVID-19. And I'm wondering how you're getting through this chapter, what your primary tools and or qualities or traits are.
Well, I quite like chaos and it's a very chaotic time. I mean, I do worry though about the company, about the world that we'll emerge into, but it's definitely a time to rethink what you're doing and to take advantage of a bit of mind space, although most of it taken up with phone conferences actually. So that seems to become the thing where I thought I'd actually be using my hands a lot more. I've been stuck in front of a computer screen more than I've ever been before in my life. It's kind of shocking. I do think that there's, there's definitely going to be a readjustment, and you put a lot of time and energy into thinking what shape your company can be to face up to a new future, which is evolving and changing every day. So it's an interesting time to think about how you can survive, which is, certainly sharpens the mind, that's for sure.
And how about you on a personal level? Like, are you handling this with, I guess, more optimism because it's an opportunity and you thrive in chaos? Or are you sometimes consumed with your own fears and of survival for your family? And
well, I mean, it's not got to that yet. And, I think you don't want to over-dramatize it. But, I worry more about the 200 people that are in my employ and how we can possibly pay them when there's no business being done, no goods being moved, nothing being made. So that's the thing that worries me. I worry for the manufacturers. I worry for the dealers and distributors that we supply. So I'm not taking it frivolously, and it requires some pretty tough decisions just to keep believing that you can come out the other end. So I think it's affecting everybody. But at the same time, I think that there is also a degree of hysteria, which you have to be careful not to, or not to, sink into deep depression right now.
Is there a chapter of your life prior to this that you think maybe trained you?
Well, I've lived through half a dozen crises that looked like they were going to be never ending. There was when I was a teenager, there was only power 3 days a week, and you weren't allowed to have baths that were more than 3 inches deep. And there was strikes all over the world, and violence. And, I remember, things that seemed more scary than this, actually. So I don't doubt that there'll be a new beginning.
What are the simple pleasures that are bringing you peace right now? And it sounds like you thrive in chaos, so maybe peace isn't something that ever eludes you.
Nature is chaos, isn't it, as well?
Yes, yes.
You've only got to watch an Attenborough documentary. Well, in fact, I was watching the Jane Goodall documentary last night. So there is more television, definitely. But it's spring in London. It's kind of, you're seeing rebirth all around you, and for sure the stars are brighter because there's less pollution, the flowers are coming out, there's more birds, and the insects still seem to be struggling. There's not so many butterflies or anything, but it's an unusually warm and early spring. And although there's a lot of being stuck inside, I'm fortunate to have some outdoor space and be close to a lot of greenery. London is one third parks as well. So, and we've seen people with much, much more severe lockdowns, because we have some things made in China, and we have some things made in Italy, that they've had, both of those nations have had much more severe lockdowns than we have. And it was probably even scarier because there was no prehistory to it. So, in a way, I'm fortunate, and I see, signs right now of a bit of light at the end of the tunnel. I mean, the infection rate today has dropped hugely in the UK. And they're already talking about the restrictions loosening a bit. So I think it'll do some good to some people to have had to take time off work, but it's going to be a disaster economically, that's for sure.
Fast forwarding to further in the future, let's say when this is in our rearview mirror, what's your most optimistic vision for your future?
You've got to hope that people, that somehow other people get used to consuming a bit less and flying a bit less and realizing that there's a link between this and the destruction of the natural world. It gives me a chance to reassess, what I do and what I make and who I make it for. And so I'll be looking at readjusting all of that. Churchill said, never waste a good crisis.
I think that's solid advice. And we'll be staying tuned to see what creative genius comes out of this. I wonder if there is a current project that you want to share with our listeners that we can look forward to, either in the pipeline or that's out right now, that you want to call attention to.
You know, we do, in the majority, lighting is the biggest part of our business. And lighting is a kind of, you know, really exciting field to work in and has been for a few years, with, you know, the whole industry being powered by amazing engineering and scientific innovation in transformers and LEDs and all the rest of it. So we've been working recently with some good friends of us as in Innsbruck that have a professional lighting company, a track lighting mainly, which is very discreet and very minimal. Anyway, they make it all in the mountains of Innsbruck, and they've managed to keep their factory open during the whole crisis, and we're able to launch this series of very flat and very basic LED panels with them, which is something we've been doing over the last couple of days. So what's kind of nice is the, you know, where normally our lamps are made in reasonably big quantities and then sent all the way around the world, these are made to order. So they're not made until somebody orders them, and then they're delivered 5 or 6 days later. So there's an efficiency about it. It plays into my interest in engineering. It's using, you know, some of my most recent thinking about circuit boards, which are really the things that power the modern world, you know. And you know, I'm really keen to see if we can do a significantly different business model, but also a different way of lighting spaces technically. You know, we've been very decorative, if you like, and so it's kind of nice to work in a field which is now much more about technical lighting and, you know, light output and how you illuminate spaces architecturally rather than decoratively. So that's my latest wheeze. And of course, you know, it's been really difficult this month, because this month is normally the Milan Furniture Fair, which is the big event for us in Europe, in fact global event that I'm sure you've been to. But we've been unable to launch anything of the normal things that we do. So what was quite nice was having these other projects, which should have been probably less visible and less obvious, being the only things that we can launch right now, because they don't depend on these quite complicated global supply chains and distribution chains, which, you know, we've been part of for so long. So it's trying to rethink what we make and who we sell it to, which is what I was talking about earlier, includes trying to make things in a more bespoke way and a more personal way, but in a very technical way as well. And what's astonishing is that that's not done, you know, in some remote location. It's done in the beautiful ski resorts above Innsbruck.
Yes. What's the name of this project?
It's called Code, like Morse code. So it uses, you know, two or three very simple modules, which themselves are, you know, you can adapt and specify in your own way. So it's really about also only designing up to a point and then liberating a system to other designers to then adapt to their own needs. A bit like a Meccano kit or a Lego kit.
Yes, lighting Legos. Well, this has been really interesting. Thank you for sharing your whole trajectory and your personality with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. To see images of Tom Dixon's work and read the show notes, click the link in the details of this episode on your podcast app. Or, even better, go to cleverpodcast.com, where you can also sign up for our newsletter. If you haven't already, please subscribe to Clever on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you would, please do us a favor and rate and review. It really helps. It really helps. We love it when you reach out to us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can find us at Clever Podcast, and you can find me at Amy Devers. Clever is produced by 2VDE Media, with editing by Rich Stroffolino and music by L1011. Clever is proudly distributed by Design Milk.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.